Hello, I'm Tom Edwards, and this is The Big Interview on Monocle 24, our one-on-one show where people with fascinating lives, enviable careers, and plenty of great tales sit down and tell us how they got where they are today, what inspires them, and perhaps what makes them tick. My guest today is one of Croatia's leading political figures, a former foreign minister, deputy speaker of her country's parliament, and president of the Croatian People's Party since 2013. An outspoken liberal advocate of gender equality and human rights, she was also a driving force behind her country's European integration and accession. And perhaps most pertinently today, she's vying for the top job at the United Nations. Vesna Pusic's career began in academia, but it wasn't long until it evolved into political activity, from founding the first feminist organisation in the former Yugoslavia, to directing a think tank focused on democracy, to publishing and editing a journal on Eastern European affairs. By the turn of the millennium, Pusic was elected an MP and is now a household name in Croatia. And Vesna Pusic joins me now in Midori House in London. Vesna Pusic, welcome to The Big Interview. Great to have you with us here in Midori House. I wanted to start off really the interview by talking a bit about the EU, predictably enough, perhaps you might say. Where do you think we're at now, a continent that seems to be losing a bit of confidence in itself and in its grand project? Do you think we're at a crisis point, really, for the EU at the moment?
Yeah, we are. We are. It's definitely a sort of low point and certainly crisis point. But I would say I certainly see this as an additional argument to try to work it out and work it out together and stay together as a really loose association of states. Mm. This is not a super state as some might have wanted in the past, or some want to project it or present it in this way. It's far from a super state, but it is some kind of, you know, thinking bigger than yourself. And I think that if anything, we need more of this at the moment. This was, I think, shaken by the big financial crisis in the 2000s, in 2007, 2008. Before that, since I was very much involved in this entire EU accession process of my own country, Croatia, and I might say also of the whole region, although maybe for us it means also something else. It's sort of a state-building exercise and a number of different things. But I watched the whole process from the 90s and certainly from the 2000s. And there was this extreme enthusiasm and reuniting Europe and sort of a little bit of generosity, not maybe necessarily a common characteristic of all politics. But there was that too. There was that, you know, sort of feeling a little bit good about yourself because you were not so extremely selfish and the lowest common denominator in everything that you touched. However, the economic and financial crisis, I think, changed all that. And that then combined with, you know, financial difficulties, economic difficulties, triggered and in a way gave space and a rise to extreme nationalist, chauvinist, right-wing segments of the political elite, although they tried to present themselves as alternatives, as non-political elites, as non-elites and non-political. But actually what they were and what they are trying to, in a way, reestablish narrow-mindedness and selfishness as a main principle of European politics. Now, it's not foreign to Europe. Europe has certainly had that in abundance in its history. This is why this European Union project, which at the same time I would say is very modest and very grand, very ambitious. It's very ambitious because it wants to include so many countries with so different traditions and cultures and languages and what have you. It's modest because it's not really building a super state. It's, I would say, making live next to each other a little bit easier.
And is that balance between that, the modesty of the operation and the scale of the ambition, is it still right, do you think? Or do you think there needs to be a reassessment? Obviously, we're sitting, what, a week or two away from this so-called Brexit vote in this country. Do you think it would take, let's say, hypothetically, the UK voted to leave? Would that supply a shock that would force more of a re-evaluation? Or is there an appetite, do you sense, when you talk to colleagues, that you know, there is an appetite to look again at whether that balance is right.
I don't know how much appetite there is for that, but there is definitely what I sensed throughout, and I'm, as you can see, a relatively enthusiastic European, but there is a lack of leadership. This is true. In a way, a lot of things are being taken for granted. There is a lack of a common vision that makes you a little bit excited about the whole project, about the what you can do. Most of the things that are good about it are taken for granted. And therefore, we only talk about things that are bad, but we're not doing much about that. Mm. And this is where I think Britain is so important and has been so important, because with all its uneasy relationship with the European Union, Britain has actually very often brought onto the agenda some of the things that needed talking about, that everybody's unhappy about. This bureaucracy that's self-serving in a way, that's its own purpose, that becomes a class unto itself, over-regulation, all kinds of things that almost of necessity happen if you have an organization like that. And you have to check it. You have to roll back certain things. And Britain has been very good at that. It has been very good at bringing this common sense approach to Europe, which I think Europe needs. But it also needs a little bit of, when I say leadership, I really mean a shared enthusiasm, a shared excitement about what we can do in the future. And that definitely is not the case at the moment. And maybe also some of the problems that European countries are facing are being somehow explained through the faults of the European Union rather than through the faults of the European communication that's faulty in spite of the European Union.
Well, let me ask you a bit more about the scene in Croatia then, because we've already talked about this rise in nationalism or populism or whatever you might call it. And there's a sense perhaps that Croatia is drifting maybe back towards some of those themes. There's various people in the post in government, the culture minister, for example, who have some controversial view, shall we say, about recent history. How worried are you about that in domestic terms? And what's the medicine? What's the solution?
I was part of a government that was in power for 4 years. It was a sort of liberal, social democratic, center, left of center coalition. In our part of Europe, that generally means not being chauvinistic primarily, because in Eastern Europe and Southeastern Europe, left and right is almost always about extreme nationalism. Mm. It's not about the tax model of taxation or return on capital or whatever. It's about these very, very elementary and basic things.
Do you think that's to do with being a relatively youthful democracy?
Yeah,
is that
of course.
One of the challenges?
Absolutely. You'll learn as you go along. I mean, that's absolutely true. There is, including such facts that are probably very difficult for you to understand. And this is that in Croatia, you have to be very much a hands-on minister, because there is, you're leading the work at the ministry. You're designing the institutional setup while you're there. It's not like you have public administration that's working regardless. And as you have in the Foreign Office, they prepare the books before you come in. There's nothing there. You really start from. But the advantage is that you come in and you actually, if you have some ideas, you can implement them and you can start new things. And this is what we did. We lost the elections, or in a way, nobody won. A movement sort of that was created 3 months before the elections got, instead of 3 to 5 mandates, they got 19 mandates, entered the parliament. This was an expression, I think, that's pretty universal, of general dissatisfaction with politics and frustration with politics. And in the end, they formed the government with the right-wing, at the moment, pretty far right-wing party that actually used at one point to be center-right, but unfortunately now has gone very much to the right. And this was a very difficult situation that we had. It took them a long time to form this coalition. We had elections the end of first week in November last year. The government was formed in January. and is now basically falling apart. It's now resigning. It did certain things that were difficult to understand, but I would say that some things did change. The difference is also social media. It's unbelievable because social media until recently were 70% very right-wing, as it, I think, is almost everywhere. But since this started happening, there was a lot of voice on the social media, and it happens instantly. And these groups are formed instantly. So I would say more than any political party leading this resistance to, in a way, this re-traditionalizing of Croatian politics and society, it was really the voice of the people on the social media, in different areas of, you know, media, culture, education, even business, that said, this is not going to pass. I mean, this is, we've been there, we don't want to go there.
So do you think that means then if you are a, I don't know what you'd call yourself, a progressive politician, I suppose, rather than being part of a generation that were fostering similar beliefs, is it, or has it been, was it certainly earlier in your career, a slightly lonely journey then? If you were an advocate of rights for people, or if you were trying to push women's rights or for other groups, was that lonely politically? Did you, have you found that in your, career?
You know how it is. It's important how the people that you know, your immediate surrounding, react. And you're not so aware of the general society. You're aware of your friends. And I mostly had friends who had similar opinions. So in the 70s, when we started with this women's rights and this women's group, there was exactly seven of us who got together in the kitchen of a friend of mine. But in about a month, there were always over 1,000 of us. And as I said, we didn't have NGOs. We couldn't do anything. We couldn't register. So an old professor of ours, since a number of us were sociologists, said, okay, kids, you can be part of the sociological association. So this is how we started organizing. The reason why there were so many of us in such a short period of time was A, because I think the time was right, but B, because we were attacked by absolutely everybody. Because in a way, it was seen as sufficiently political to be interesting and sufficiently politically non-dangerous to again be free for all. So we were attacked from many different sides. That rose our visibility immensely in a very short period of time and got us a lot of support. And this topic has actually been with us through different groups, different generations of people. Since then, you know, we were very intellectual, I would say. We read books and wrote. After us came people who were much more activists, shelters, concrete action, and probably things that were very needed. But the topic has stayed. The times that were lonely politically were the 90s, really. The 90s, especially early 90s. Because in 1990, when we had the referendum, and 91, when independence was established of certainly Croatia and Slovenia, and then eventually some other countries, or all of the countries or republics of former Yugoslavia, that was a big sort of almost a logical end to what had been happening before that. But then the war came, and for a while, it was again a very unifying experience because you were, you know, people were defending their homes and their country. And also, this is one thing that I think is very useful for anybody who wants to be in politics, especially in international relations and multilateral organizations, that you have this experience that no matter what other people think, nobody in any country that has been at war expected the war or expects the war to happen to you. It's always something that happens to others, but certainly not. This is impossible in this country. I mean, until I saw on television actual tanks on the highway of brotherhood and unity coming from Belgrade towards Zagreb, I didn't believe that. And I'm a social scientist. I read books, still couldn't believe that a war could happen in my country.
So, do you think there's a complacency then maybe within, it's interesting at the top we talked about the EU and these institutions, is there a complacency? Have people got short memories politically, historically? Have they forgotten how recently these things have happened?
This is extremely recent. This was like 25 years ago. And I mean, it started 25 years ago. It's 23 years ago, 20 years ago. 20 years ago, we were still reintegrating parts of the country. And anybody who's been through a war knows the worst part of the war is post-war. This is the really, really difficult part. And also it happened in Europe, but it happened in the sort of, you know, lower right-hand corner of the map of Europe. So people didn't take it as something that really happened to Europe. Yeah, it was out there. It was this crazy Balkans. But it's actually very close. Yeah, I flew for 2 hours from Zagreb to here. We go back and forth. You go back and forth. Everybody goes back and forth between the Mediterranean, the Adriatic coast, and here it's very close. However, I would say that Europeans didn't experience it as something that in a way happened to them, although it happened to Europe. And even in Croatia sometimes, you know, people feel, this was a long time ago, and take a lot of things for granted. But it actually is extremely possible. I mean, it's you know, many institutions are so fragile sometimes. And this could easily be seen, for instance, during the last fall refugee migrant crisis. Where you had members of the European Union reacting very differently, some countries going completely berserk. And I can tell you from my own personal experience, it is a matter of leadership, exclusively a matter of leadership. The leadership can create hysteria, being incapable of dealing with the situation, being incapable of dealing with it in an orderly way, of presenting it in a normal way to their own citizens, and people go crazy. Or you can provide the leadership that actually can take care of these people, especially on this famous Balkan route, because from the 16th of the September 2015 till the end of the year, so this is October, November, December, plus half of September, 3.5 months, 658,000 people came through Croatia, which is a country of 4.3 million. But we never had more than 10,000 people in the country at one time. This is true for all the countries except Austria and Germany. But everybody else, Hungary, Serbia, Macedonia, Slovenia, nobody had any, not to speak about Czech Republic and Slovakia, where nobody even came. And there was hysteria. So it really depends on how you approach this issue. We approached it at that time as something where you need high levels of organization, which we had. The general tone was we need to help these people. Maybe the fact that they entered from Serbia, meaning they entered Eastern Slavonia first, where almost everybody has been refugee in the 90s during the war, and saying to people, you know, these are people like we were 20 years ago or 25 years ago. People had that firsthand experience, knew how it felt. There was absolutely no problem. I mean, you know, we discussed it. It cost money and all of that. But in terms of people going crazy or anything like that,
and that was set by leadership. I mean, it's interesting talking then about the strength of will and how you define your political leadership. We should then talk about the candidacy for the United Nations Secretary General post, because there's obviously a lot of talk. There's a belief that we could be looking at somebody from Eastern Europe. We could be looking at a woman. Obviously, this is something which you check both those boxes. Let's say that happens, whether it's you, Vesna, whether it's somebody else. What message would that send from the United Nations if they were to make an appointment of that character?
Well, it will depend very much on the personality. And the post of the Secretary General is such that she or he, so far, because there's never been a woman Secretary General of the United Nations, that he has very limited powers if you look at the charter. He's sort of a caretaker of the organizational part of the United Nations. And people who had influence and who actually built this role of the Secretary General as such an important and influential role did it not because of the formal powers of the Secretary General, but because of the strength of the personality and courage occasionally, and a sense of mission, a sense of leadership, not crazy sense of mission, but sense of, you know, that you actually have, you cannot be cynical. This would be the worst, because this is uninspiring, boring, kills all creativity and defeats the purpose. You have to care about the things that the United Nations stand for. Have there been lots of compromises? Absolutely. Have there been a lot of failures? I'm first to vouch for that, because we had one of the biggest UN peacekeeping missions on our own soil, the UNPROFOR, which was in Croatia and Bosnia-Herzegovina, with all the failings and failures of how the mandate was defined, whether they could, was there any peace to be kept? Could they create peace? No. Were they, was the mission defined well enough to serve the purpose? No. You had Srebrenica. So you had, still, having said all of these things, there is no other place like the United Nations where you actually can bring everybody together. And in the end, it stays the only place where everybody can talk to everybody else. Having been through a major conflict, I would say that, you know, a million years of talking is better than one day of war. So talk as much as you want, but...
And what about the appetite, though, for real change? Because you mentioned there's, a small-C conservatism within the institution. We've had previous Secretary Generals who've attempted to, say, introduce some change, whether it's structural or organisational, and there's been a great deal of reservation about it. We've already mentioned that you're sort of rather a progressive thinker. Is it an institution within which you could function? It was interesting to think even about, you know, Saudi Arabia cautioning over, you know, oh, well, don't, you know, impact your social values on other people. Even before any job comes around, you realise the impediments that you'd be facing.
But this is true. I come certainly from an environment where I have had a long and rich training in sort of having the strength of the word as the only instrument, and being in small minorities, sometimes in minority of one. I feel quite comfortable in that. I have no problems with that, as long as you allow me to state my case. And I'm prepared to listen to everybody else, no matter how small the country or how big the country. But we have two categories of candidates at the moment. One are the people who are coming from the system, who have worked for years within the UN system. The other is the group, like me, people who have experience, who have been foreign ministers or worked in the government, but are not coming from the UN system. I think each group has its advantages and its drawbacks. The people who come from the system, their advantage is that they're a known quality and quantity. You know what to expect. Their disadvantage is that they're not going to bring anything new and unexpected and maybe refreshing. The other group, like us, is that there is a much bigger chance that we will bring something new and exciting to the job and to the organization.
But is that too frightening? It's like the old thing of turkeys voting for Christmas. I mean, is it too much to expect an institution like this to make the bold choice and go with, if you like, an outsider candidate?
I don't think they will be deciding based on that. And I recognize the danger of outsiders, because you never know who's crazy, who isn't. You know, this in politics is a serious issue. And it could be somebody who is, you know, great and creative and intellectually exciting, but it could also be a loony. And then you're stuck with okay, there's the organization is inert enough, I think, to bog down anybody. But this is the risk with the other group. I don't think it's going to be, well, maybe I'm mistaken, but my feeling is that the decision is not going to be made so much based on insiders, outsiders. that it is the permanent members, and the permanent members are the United States, Russia, China, UK, and France, that they have different expectations from different candidates. And all the permanent members of the Security Council somehow feel that some candidates might be better in a way for them. And I think they need to find a compromise. They need to find a candidate that I think it's not necessarily anybody's first choice, but is acceptable to everybody.
Vesna, just finally, in terms of how this process has worked, then there's been a lot of talk about it being more transparent, and we certainly yes. seem to have seen a lot more of the inner workings. Has that reassured you that this is an organisation that's moving in the right direction, or does it ever worry you that it's maybe a sop to certain critics to try and present it in that light? Do you think this is an organisation that can get to grips with change? It could engage with a more progressive figurehead. Are you reassured and excited by those developments?
I think this is not a sham, this opening of the... Because this is a very small thing, if you think about it. There were different proposals to change the organizational structure of the UN, the whole process, all kinds of things. Opening this selection process, just this one little segment of the selection process, having interviews with the candidates in front of the world media and all 193 states, was seen originally as a very, very small concession, very small move in the direction of people who were pushing for much bigger moves. I was completely aware when I took part in this whole thing that nobody, including the people who came up with these suggestions, nobody expected this to have that much influence. And if nothing else, it did a fantastic public relations job for the organization. I mean, in the previous, and I was interested in politics all my life, in the previous selections of the Secretary General, nobody had a clue what was happening, who stood for what, why. Nobody's interested until it was announced. Now there is a lot of interest around the world in the process. The fact that this small step has introduced so much change and so much interest, created so much interest in the organization, I would say shows not necessarily that it would be easy to change the organization. Because it won't. It's a very complicated and in many ways petrified organization. And it's extremely important to keep all the membership in, because the moment you start losing membership, the whole organization loses its purpose. But one thing it did show is that in an organization like that and of that basic profile and with those objectives, even small change is big change.
Fantastic. Vesna Pusic, thanks so much for coming to talk to us on The Big Interview.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Big Interview with me, Tom Edwards, in conversation today with Vesna Pusic. The show is produced by Bill Luty, research by Gaia Lutz and Faith Barker, and edited by Nina Norek. Until next time, all that's left to say is goodbye, and thank you very much for listening.